Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Mac, and you are listening to Mac's Musings. My guest tonight is Richard Mogg, and the phone should be dialing.
There we go. Hello.
Hello, Richard. This is Mac.
Hi, Mac. How you doing?
Okay, and how are you?
I'm very good. Are we on the air right now?
Yes, we are.
We can hear each other. I think I hear Santa Claus. Oh, my goodness. Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas to you.
You're funny.
Oh, well, by George, that Santa Claus, he dropped me out of his sleigh, so he's going to have to come back and give an apology. But, hey, everything's good, and I'm ready to talk. Let's have a good show.
Okay. Well, I'll ask you a pretty much standard question. Why did you want to start in the filmmaking business?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first off, I should say that I probably, just like a lot of other hundreds of people that love horror movies and love movies in general, I grew up watching them, and I thought, that is the job for me, to make a movie, to make something that can make somebody feel emotions and be enthralled and just be touched and emotionally by a simple movie, something you watch and listen to. I thought, that's powerful. I got to do something like that. And you know, when I was young, I thought the biggest place was working in the video store. But I kind of realized, well, somebody makes the movies too. So I looked further than that.
Hey, I loved working in the video store.
Oh, so did I. You know, I spent years in video stores. I probably worked in, I think, 3 different ones before they all closed down, you know. But,
right.
Oh, that was it. Everything was movies. And, of course, going to school, eventually after high school, well, even in high school, I was doing acting and things like that. But getting into college and university, I went to film school and just pursued it like nobody's business. You know, I filled my breadth. I had done all of the other studies, creative writing, philosophy. In fact, I, for a while, pursued a double minor in philosophy and film. But I was film all the way, just to be making movies.
Mm. Do you have a favorite filmmaking hat?
Well, you know, the truth is, when you're making a movie as a director, and it's almost always as the director for me, but you wear every hat because, you know, that's what you do, especially low budget. You're the director, your job is to solve problems, right? So really, if something is someone is not showing up for the day, or something's not going right, or something you planned is turning out wrong, you got to step in and sort of, you know, help and offer ideas and come up with a new way to do it. So the director sort of wears a lot of hats, really.
True. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Mac. I was just going to say, I should ask, did you explain that also I'm from Canada? I'm up in Vancouver, BC, which is in Canada, just over the border there. So it's pretty much the same, because Vancouver is a little bit like Hollywood North, but I'm independent. So it's really a pretty neat game up here. There are other independents, but we very nicely can operate without being bothered, I should say, can make productions. And as long as you have some type of a means of doing it, you can go pretty much under the radar, which is a good thing, I should say.
Well, yeah. Yeah, you don't have the trappings of the other things. Not that some of the stuff is okay, like, you know, here with the COVID restrictions and that. There's nothing wrong with the COVID restrictions, of course, but it's like with a lot of things, they may go a little bit overboard. But if you want to make a movie in Hollywood, you have to abide by all of those. But if you're independent, you can slide past some of it. You could probably slide past a lot of it, but then you're not a good filmmaker because you're not caring about the people that are working for you.
That's true too. And I should say the COVID stuff now that's current is been a hindrance for everything. Basically, we're not shooting at all right now. But in typical fashion for us, at least up here, we're not being hounded for permits. And pretty much, if we find a private area that's, you know, you're not bothering anybody, you can get away with shooting. I mean, I'll tell you a story later, but we actually shot a whole feature film in practically the back of a park because it was private. And again, we're not disturbing anyone. And pretty much it's commonplace, but people just turn the other way. It's not a very heightened sensitivity so much. But then again, it can be too. The city is busy and it can always be a bit of a game back and forth. But either way, I just wanted to point out that I'm up in Canada for all the listeners up there. So I'm that crazy guy, the crazy Canadian.
I don't think Canadians are crazy. I just thought
there
it was. I've been up there many, many times, but I remember one of the first times that I went, I was still a teenager. And I know what Canadian bacon is here, you know, what we call Canadian bacon. But I had gone with a friend, and he didn't expect it. He ordered Canadian bacon, and it came back with, you know, regular old bacon. And he said, "Well, I ordered Canadian bacon." And the waiter said, "Yeah, that's Canadian bacon. It's from a Canadian pig." And we so then we just laughed and laughed because he was right. It was from a Canadian pig. And so then later he explained to us that, you know, what we call Canadian bacon, obviously you don't call Canadian bacon.
Well, you know, I actually don't call it that either. But truthfully, I think the only difference I noticed was when I asked for vinegar one time. I was down in the States and I asked for vinegar and they thought I was crazy. And I said, "Oh, no, it's for the fries." And they still thought I was crazy. So I think that was the only difference I noticed. But it's very American here, totally. I would never notice a difference personally, mostly because, again, we're so close to the border and everything is media shared,
right,
and all that. And, again, this is all with exception. This year has been totally different. This COVID business
right.
is insane. You know, I'm speaking more just in a general sense for that. But about all the audience and everybody I'm in contact with, all my good friends that I've been in touch with for the books and everything, they're all in the States. They're all in America there. And some are even Canadians that went to work and live in the States even. Some very good friends I could tell you about later. All of them mostly relate to the books, which is such good stories. But really, I've never met anybody who's just not totally just a fantastic person. I think I find that once we all have common interests and so forth, it's just nothing but genuine kindness and love. I tell you, it's been wonderful. Can't believe
it. Good.
Yeah.
Well, since you mentioned your books, I don't want to go too far into it because we want to talk about your movies a little bit, and it's only an hour show. But talk about your books a little bit since you already mentioned them. You might as well go ahead and talk about
them. I sure will. Well, I sure will. Like I say, I went to film school first, and I was working on film, and I've done a number of feature films, plus shorts, and a number of other things, too. But a while back, I started writing ideas probably 8 to 9 years ago now, we're talking. I was looking at shot-on-video horror films, which I have grown up and loved. I've been a fan all my life, all the stuff. You know, the idea that you could make a movie on an analog camcorder and then get distribution and actually see yourself in video stores. And this was in the 80s, and I couldn't believe it. It really inspired me so much so that, I really took notice of it, and I've always been a fan of these things. So I started about 8 or 9 years ago, and my favorite shot-on-video film is Blood Lake from 1987 by director Tim Boggs. And it's a fantastic film. It's really, it's sort of timeless. It's a summer movie. Kids go into a cabin by a lake. You know, there's a killer. And it's just totally not mean-spirited. It's very fun. And I've watched it so many times. I tell you, my wife thought I was insane because every year I'd watch it 20 to 40 times a year. I'm not exaggerating. But so anyway, I about 8 or 9 years ago, I got in contact with, as you would know, Andrea Adams. She was one of the stars of the movie. She had been in prior shot-on-video films too, The Ripper, most notably, and she's a lead in that one, and Revenge, the sequel to Blood Cult, which was another big hit shot-on-video movie. So Andrea actually turned me over to where she knew to contact Tim Boggs on Facebook. This was like 9 years ago. So I managed to contact him, and I thought, if anything, I would just ask him a few questions about Blood Lake. There had never been a DVD or a special written about it, just questions I would ask as a fan. And he took the questions. There were like 10 questions. He took a few weeks to get back to me. It was email. Sorry, not Facebook. Email. What am I thinking? Anyway, he wrote me a 22-page, like, autobiography. 22 pages. And it was not just about the making of Blood Lake. It was his history, his growing up, his love for film, his wanting to make a movie, his meeting of the producer and writer. And it was the entire experience, and then the afterwards, the release, how they all grew and maybe lost contact. It was just amazing. And I right away thought, man, this is something special. This has got to be in a book. It's not just like me asking questions. This is amazing. So I sort of sat on it. I didn't know what to do. I thanked him, but I didn't know what to do. And I took almost 7 years to take all of this, and it was more like 5 years, but after that I started thinking this will be a book, and I made it a mission. I said I have to chronicle from the very beginning, 1982, of shot on video horror films. And I did that, and I thought, where am I going to cap it? So I thought, well, 1995 is the good year to cap it, because 96 was Wes Craven's Scream, totally changed the horror landscape. Also, right, DVDs were coming out. That, again, changed the landscape for independence. And internet, too. There were so many reasons why 95 was a good year to stop. So that first book, it goes from the beginning, 82, with also some back history for camcorders and things like that. And then it goes to 95. And it chronicled as many shot-on-video horror films as I could find, feature lengths. And that wasn't just it, because it was enough to chronicle the movies. I mean, nobody knew how many movies there were. I mean, these are the things. They were released regionally. They may not even had a official VHS release, you know. So it was very difficult to chronicle and find out just what were the movies and could I get a hold of them, for one thing. But then I thought, it's not just this and Tim Boggs' write-up. It has to be more than this. So I went out and I pursued, and I got tons. I think there were 17 or 18 of the major players in the shot-on-video horror genre to give interviews. And I've got lengthy interviews with these guys. I mean, we're talking Mark Polonia, Tim Ritter, Joel D. Weinkoop, Donald Farmer, Todd Jason Cook, James L. Edwards, David the Rock Nelson, Gary Whitson from Wave Video, Ron Bach. The list just goes on. So, I mean, in terms of this first book, it's called Analog Nightmares, the shot-on-video horror films from 1982 to 1995. It was a labor of love, but it took many years to put that thing together. And I learned so much from these guys, so many things. I mean, the quotes I could just tell you, the things I learned from these guys. Mark Polonia, I'll just tell you this one before I stop to take a break. Mark Polonia, the director everybody knows, was twin directors with Splatter Farm, Feeders, and so forth, and has continued to this day making independent films. He told me, you know, here's the secret, really. It doesn't matter if someone watches your movie and is inspired by it or says, gosh, that was so bad, I can do better than that. It doesn't matter, because the outcome is the same. They're going to go on and do something. And I thought, man, and that was just the first little bit of inspiration I got. But one of the real big interviews in that book, I don't know how I managed to get this, but I got in contact with Doug Stone, who, if nobody recognizes the name Doug Stone, he was an actor in Toronto, Canada in the mid 80s. And he starred in a shot on video horror film called Shock Chamber. Now, he did other ones too. Shock Chamber is probably the biggest one because he's in three different roles through it. It's an anthology horror film. It aired on TV in Toronto, and then it went to VHS, and it was in almost every video store in the late 80s. I got him, and I met him, and he is the nicest gentleman. He lives in L.A., I believe, and he's still doing voiceover. In fact, his whole career went to voiceover. He was one of the main characters in Mask, M-A-S-K, that animated series, and he's done so many things on anime and so forth. He's still active today. Nicest gentleman in the world. I'm still in contact with him as well. So many fortunes have come out of that book. I could again go on with you. I'll take a break, but just there's a wealth of information in the book. So many lengthy interviews, and the contacts have maintained. We've been all friends for years now since the book came out, and it's just been phenomenal. So that's about the first book. Yeah. Anyway,
well, if you want to talk about a little bit more, you can. It's not like you can't talk at all. I mean, you know, if you feel like you need to say something else, go ahead. If you want to move on to another book, go ahead.
Well, thank you. And that, there is something I want to say, and I want to say it right now. I want to thank you for this chance to come out and talk on this show. And I really want to give thanks to everybody that's aided me or helped me and put out films on distribution over the years. You know, when I was early doing films, and I had shot stuff before I had done feature lengths, but really, straight out of film school, we all thought, the friends and I from film school, we thought, let's make a feature film. So we did, and that was 2010's Easter Bunny Bloodbath. We finished that film school in 2008, but we thought, hey, let's throw it and make a feature film, Easter Bunny Bloodbath. Well, you know, it wasn't too long before I got a hold of a lot of good distribution. First with that film, I had Briarwood Entertainment, which was a very small output, but they put it on VHS, which was so key to me. That's what we made it for, was video. And then I got into even more distribution deals, some I can't even recall, but I really nailed it in with SRS Cinema and Ron Bonk. He got a copy of my third or fourth film that was called Massage Parlor of Death. And it was a cheesy thing. It was meant to be like those early 90s shot on video films. And he loved it. He got it. And we put that out right away. And he did the smartest thing of all. When I made that film, I shot it HD, but I intended to have a VHS output of it. So we would crop it to 4x3 and we'd run it through the VCR so it looked official analog. Well, Ron Bonk put it out on DVD and Blu-ray with both the HD and the VHS version. I mean, I couldn't give him more thanks because that's phenomenal, the idea of having the movie on there in two complete different ways to view it. So Ron Bonk and SRS Cinema, I know we had such a great deal. He's put out a total of four of my features. The Massage Parlor of Death, Easter Bunny Bloodbath, he put that out again. Bangin' Vengeance, which was my second film, and Teenage Slumber Party Nightmare, which is, I believe, my fifth film. And these are all features. And they're loaded. They got commentaries and stuff. But Ron Bonk, he really put us out there in a more major way. Because his outreach was wide, universal. And, I mean, I literally had people from Vietnam contacting me to say they liked Easter Bunny Bloodbath. And I was thinking, my gosh, that's not the best movie. But, hey, they liked it in Vietnam. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
And then since then, I've made more films and made more contacts. I got to give a thanks to Sean Donahue from Gatorblade Films. I mean, I have something out on Screen Time Films, which is with Todd Jason Cook. And just every work, everything you do inspires. I mean, that is the whole mantra of what you do. I mean, you're doing it because you love it. Making movies is what I'm talking about. You want to pursue that because you love it. It's not really for money or anything. But making movies with other people empowers them as well. You know, whether it's the actor or the sound guy or whatever you're working with, they want to do the best that they can do. And if you give them the opportunity to do so, they take that chance and they work towards the same goals that you're working towards. And it's a group effort. It's love. That's kind of the whole bit about all the films I make, is that it's a group effort towards love. It really is, you know. But then to have the final stage after your film is done, that to have somebody else recognize it and say, yeah, I think that's going to be sellable, or it's going to work. And they pick it up and they put it out there. The viewers get to see it. and the viewers get inspired. And that's happened. It's happened so much. Again, I don't want to just keep rambling. But that's sort of the beauty of making independent cinema for me. It's just about the constant highs and lows of production, the gratitude of seeing it completed, and then the turnaround where it might still get terrible reviews. You might just get laughed right off the face of the earth for whatever you've done. But the fact that somebody has given it time and even maybe enjoyed it, and then the third stretch has inspired them, is just the whole point of making movies, for me at least. It really, really is.
Yeah, well, I've told people, you know, being a semi-professional critic myself, I've reminded my filmmaker friends that don't worry too much about what critics say, because many of them don't even actually watch the films. They just fast forward through them. So they're not even saying what they really think. They're just saying, oh, okay, it looks like this through fast forward, so I'll just say this. And if you ever read a review and then watch the film, you can tell that many of them have not even watched the film by what they say about it after you've seen it.
Oh, that's true. And some reviewers, you know, they have to do reviews. They're sort of like cattle called. They have to do it. So you want to know who your reviewer is before you sort of put a lot of stock in what they say, I think, sometimes.
Well, even the ones that are really, really famous and supposedly are fair and, you know, have that famousness for what they do, there are a lot of them, too, that do that. And I've noticed that
Absolutely.
Through the years. And I've always said, I'm never going to do that. I said to one of my other guests just the other day, I said, even if I get bored to tears watching a film, if I've been contracted to watch it, to write a review, I'm going to watch it. Even if I'm bored, even if I hate it, you know, whatever. And it's not really going to affect my review per se, because I'm not going to put, oh, I hated this film. I don't do reviews like that. No matter what, I look for something good in a film. The least little thing, whether it's locations, because sometimes a movie has absolutely nothing good in it except they have really good location shots, or they have really good music, or whatever. You know, there's always something that I can grab onto.
Oh, yeah.
Not always. There's been like maybe three times in my whole life that I've watched a film and I couldn't find one single thing that I liked about a film. But that's a very big rarity. But to give you just
a
short example.
Approach. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no,
go ahead.
You please go ahead, yeah.
Oh, no, I was just saying I didn't want to take up too much of your show, but just to give you an example, I mean, the listeners have probably heard this one a few times, but that's okay. I'll make it as short as I can. A filmmaker from France wanted to send me, he's a Facebook friend, and he wanted to send me one of his films on DVD. And so I said, well, sure, you know, because he wanted me to review it. I said, sure, go ahead. And so he said, well, now do you want it dubbed or do you want it with the closed captioning? And I said, oh, no, I speak French, so you can just send it the way it is. And he was just so ecstatic because he was like, oh, finally, somebody in the United States is going to see my film the way I intended for it to be seen. So he was excited. Yeah, because he didn't have to dub it. He didn't have to put in the closed captioning. So he was all excited, so he sent me the film. And let me put it this way. It was kind of like, and this is coming from somebody who's never been on an acid trip, so I can't really say what an acid trip looks like.
Yeah, right.
But it's what I would imagine that an acid trip looks like. And that can be interesting on one hand.
Right.
But the acting was lackluster. Everything was like subpar, you know, in my opinion. But of course, I'm not gonna, you know, bring that up. he asked me what I thought about it. And, of course, I didn't want to just pan his movie. And I said, well, I'm going to tell you something very truthfully. And I was being truthful. I said, the special visual effects in that film are some of the best that I've ever seen. And that includes big budget films. So
that's a compliment. Hey, that's pretty good.
Well,
you know, that's
the
exact approach I took with the two books because, you know, knowing that we were looking at movies where we were trying to honor or at least be respectful of all the people that put towards making films and making these movies that I was hoping to at least include in the book was exactly that, was point out the positives and realize that each one was a labor of love. Not everything is meant to be the top of the chart seller. Some of this is just straight from the heart. So yeah, I get that a lot. Yeah.
Well,
and by the way,
I
should point out that my own films are not intended to be looked at as the best of the best. So just so I say that, because I enjoy showing the seams of filmmaking and I enjoy the awkwardness of performances that are, undirected in occasion. If they're made live on the spot, I look for that spark of ambiguous scenes and dialogue that comes naturally. So I enjoy that a little bit. I know not everyone does, but I do. So yeah, it's hard to see sometimes where filmmakers' heads are at when you watch certain films.
Yeah, well, when I review a film, and I use my own 5-star system, which is a little bit different than, you know, IMDb's 10-star system. So if I write a review on there, I have to adjust it to go onto that. Because really my 5-star system ends up being 20 stars if you count the partial stars. Because I use quarter stars. Like something can have 3.25 or 3.5 or 3.75.
Oh, you really slice it down. Sure, yeah.
Well, yeah, I really do. And like I've explained to many, many a filmmaker, just the effort of making the film gets you an automatic 1-star.
Yeah.
You're never going to get less than 1-star with me because just the effort gets you that. And then everything else sometimes it doesn't even have to be like really good. If it's just not bad, you'll get a quarter star. Like one time the acting wasn't really good in this one film, but it wasn't really bad either. So I gave it a quarter star for the acting because the acting wasn't bad, even though it wasn't good.
Sure. You know, Matt, that makes me think, have you seen a lot of shot on video films that were like from the late 80s or 90s or shot on camcorder horror films?
Oh, yeah, I've seen many, many, many.
Oh, okay, because I know the amateurness of whatever their obstacle was when filming, I find it sometimes, in fact, a lot of times, charming. But I recognize the limitations of perhaps what they were trying to accomplish and sometimes what they couldn't do it physically, you know, if there was some issue or problem and then how they worked around it. I love that kind of stuff in a film. Even in Hollywood stuff, which they always try to cover it up, you know, but I love looking for those little pockets of seeing how it's a facade a little bit, you know, I like that.
Yeah. Oh, me too. Well, to get into your movies a little bit more, because you like touched on them a little bit, although you've already went over a little bit, like 4 of the ones I had on my list, because I had, you know, the Easter Bunny Bloodbath and Bangin' Vengeance and Teenage Slumber Party.
Hey, no worries. I can talk.
Massage Parlor of Death. I mean, if you wanted to say anything more about those, you know, go ahead. If not, I can move on to the next one on my list.
Oh, sure. I'll say a little bit, just to make it quick. That basically, like I said, the first Easter Bunny Bloodbath was the first attempt that myself and the other film student, we all put together to say, you know, I think we can really do a feature. What we did in shorts, let's do it as a feature. And they were so willing, so ready. And for the most part, that, again, we had to sort of define how the style was going to be, how was it going to be filmed, how are we going to do this. And it's taking me probably 3 or 4 films to start really developing the style I want to do. The comfortability of how I would direct something was to grow on screen, I suppose. So with Easter Bunny, we took it straightforward and said, make it a little bit like a slasher, like Blood Cult or Blood Lake, and move towards that kind of a movement where you just had a killer and it was one location with, you know, minimal actors, and that was it. A lot of comedy mixed in there too, but nothing terribly offensive or standoutish as negative. We were just sort of playing with the ideas. Bangin' Vengeance was the second feature that I went on to, and it was the total opposite. The idea was make it sleazy and make it more grindhousey. And in fact, we dubbed the entire film, post-dubbed, to make it like a 70s grindhouse film. I think we were all still running off of the high from Tarantino's Grindhouse and Robert Rodriguez, because we mocked it up with fake, you know, scratches and stuff. It was shot in HD video, but we made it look like it was some film stock and all this. Well, that movie was, you know, it was pretty okay. I was comfortable with it. It's about an actress wants to be famous. She gets a boob job, goes psychotic. The boobs start talking to her and tell her to kill men who wronged her. That was the plot. But, you know, we just tried to push it a bit. And the third film is actually the one I'm working on now, because we didn't ever release it. It was shot and shelved. And I personally, because my wife and I became pregnant and everything had to change in our personal lives. We had to move, get a new job, you know, and it all worked out for the best. We have 2 kids now, but I never released that third film. So I'm very eagerly working on that now. I'll explain a bit more about that later. But the fourth film was The Massage Parlor of Death. And that was the one that hit the money pay dirt with SRS Cinema, Ron Bonk, getting it out there in a big way. And again, that movie is essentially Blood Feast mixed with Death Nurse, Nick Millard's Death Nurse. Nick Millard is a huge inspiration to me. The guy can make 50 cents look like $50. And for me, that's right up my budget alley. You know, so I shot Massage Parlor of Death for literally $50. And there's a very famous story I've shared with the guys at Blood Bath and Beyond is a review YouTube website, and they really did a fantastic job reviewing this movie for me. But we bought a cot from like a department store cot and laid it down in a back room where we had it as a massage table. And every death we have in a movie, blood spills all over this cot. Well, anyway, the fact is, after we filmed the movie, I needed some more money back. So I tried to clean the cot. It still had stains of blood all over it. I folded it back up, put it in its sleeve, and brought it back with the receipt. And wouldn't you know it, they took it back. So I got my money back. This poor cot was covered in blood. I got my money back. So that was very nice. But those four pumped it out. And then to the reaching of widespread distribution on that, was really fantastic. That was a boost for what I was doing independently. I write my own films and I direct them as well, and I edit them myself. I always have done that, and I'm comfortable with that. I like the pace of my own work on it. You know, whether I do it quickly or even whether I have a life interruption and then it, you know, gets sidetracked a bit, that's the comfortability I work with. So it's really, in that sense, I like to have the hands-on approach in all aspects we can do. And actually, that is the way that I developed a flavor and a taste of how I do films. They're nothing to be saying they're the great standout pictures. I wouldn't say that. But well, we did another film later called Bigfoot Ate My Boyfriend. We were quoted as saying, you know, Richard Mogg has his own genre. It's not horror. It's not comedy. It's like the closest thing I would describe it as is think of the awkward comedic moments in The Office with, you know, the face reactions, the zoom in look on someone's face. Think of those moments. That's probably the closest similarity you could say to my films. I enjoy the zany situations with perhaps normal characters and watch how normal characters would react to zany situations. And since Massage, every film has ended with a sort of a farcical look at the ending. Something builds to a farce by the end of the picture. So that is a style I like to really work on. And that did show up in our later films, The Teenage Slumber Party Nightmare, Bigfoot Ate My Boyfriend. We did a sequel to Easter Bunny Bloodbath that was filmed in 2015, but it had never been assembled again. So what I did when COVID hit was I knew, can't really go out and shoot something. So we got to assemble something. So I started cutting that together and then sort of piecemealed it together and put it online. So that one didn't get its DVD release yet. But all of our stuff is oh, I should mention this. I'm going to jump into something here, Mac.
Hold on a second here.
The beauty, again, of having film distribution is you appreciate it so much. It takes the film out from my hands and lets it be on its own. It's like your kids growing up and, you know, moving out of the house. You let other people take it. They know how to sell it. They know how to market it. And that's beautiful. I enjoy that a lot. The other beauty thing that I just recently experienced was when your distribution rights end, the rights to your films come back to you. And in just this last 6 months, I've had the rights of 6 feature-length films come back to me. And this
cool.
is a beautiful thing. What this means is amazing. You can think, I have a new picture coming out. I want to get the next film in distribution. Well, let's say they hate the next film. I'll say, I got 2 films ready for you. I got 5 films ready. I've got 6 films ready. You know, that all of a sudden every door that would be closing for 1 or 2 pictures opens because you've got 4 or 5 ready to go off the mark. And you could do box sets. You could do the themes. You could do a lot of things. And there's no real investment because they're ready to go. So to have the rights back and now you control your own films is really amazing. I'm sitting on right now 6 finished features that I'm looking at finishing the next. And, the doors are wide for what could be done with them now. So distribution is pretty interesting. It's such a nice game. And I have never met a snake ever in distribution. And I know friends that have, and they have problems with royalties. They have problems with, you said you weren't going to sell to that territory, and you are. They have so many issues. And I look at them and I think, geez, I feel lucky. But I also know that it's not just the deals you make. It's the connections with the people. If you get a chance to meet the person who's running that company, meet them. They're just a person too, right? So it's all about respect and making a connection. And you know that who's got your interest at heart and who doesn't really, And I've never had a problem with distribution and the guys. They've been so well. I got to give my thanks again to these guys because they really work hard, and most of them are filmmakers themselves. So they know the stuff. They know how troublesome it can be. They know about films. Amazing. And Ron Bonk is a fantastic filmmaker. I got to say that. I saw it. We were screening at a local thing in Canada here in Vancouver, where they had a friend of mine, another filmmaker, Vince D'Amato. He puts on a Cinema Fantastique screening every year, except now because of COVID, where he's booking movies from all across the world. And he has his own distribution label now, too. So he had some of our stuff. He had Ron Bonk stuff. He had another filmmaker friend of mine, Drew Marvick. He had his new I'm going to have to get you the title. It's sitting right there on my shelf. Pool Party Massacre. That was what it was. it was amazing. It was a celebration of friends. Oh, and in fact, if you listen to the commentaries on Pool Party Massacre, Drew Marvick makes reference to me and my Teenage Slumber Party Nightmare because he was showing his cast between takes. He was showing them every Slumber Party movie he could find, and he came across mine, and they all sat there going, oh my God, it's terrible. How did they get distribution? And he liked it. He said, hey, if this guy can get distribution, I can get distribution. So what do you know? There you go. So that was an example of how bad your movie can be, and it inspired. But Drew and I met. He came up here for a Cinema Fantastique, and we both had these big, long beards at the time. His is more mightier than mine, But and then Lloyd Kaufman was there, too, so we all got a great shot of the 3 of us posing, and it's been fantastic. And this is something, actually, that I want to say that this is a really big thing. Because of the idea of the book, working on the book, being able to interview so many people, not just the first book, the second one, Gift Wrapped and Gutted 2, and working with them, meeting them, being on the phone for 3 hours, like on the phone for 3 hours with Donald Farmer or with Mark Polonia or Doug Stone, really just chatting with these guys. I have gotten to meet all my heroes. It's fantastic. It is such an amazing thing. And to know that they've inspired you, and then you've met them. I it's one of those things where it's a turning point in your life. The gratitude you have for it, but then to know that it continues, like Phil Herman and Dave Castiglione, he's there. These guys are in contact with me like almost daily, if not weekly, and it's been going on for years. You know, we just have mutual respect for these guys, and you know, it's just amazing. When I talked to Dave last a few days ago on your show, I had never actually spoken with him voice to voice, but you know, we write back and forth quite a lot, and he did shoot some stuff that I was able to cameo into one of my films. And Dave's a legend. I mean, he's been in so many of his wave pictures that I've been a fan of for years. I'll keep talking if it's okay, Matt.
Oh, sure. Go right ahead. It's your show.
Oh, thank you. Well, making the films was one thing. That's where my heart is, you know. But then writing the books it was basically better than any film school you could imagine, because you're not just viewing films like six on a daily basis. You're writing about them. You're on the phone. You're talking with these people. You're getting their ask any question you can think of. The more personal, the better. You know, I mean, it's just a complete learning experience, and I'm so fortunate for it. And after that first book was done, you know, we're starting to think, you know, like what's the next step? If I've made films and now I've learned all this information from the masters, what would be the next step? And before I went into the next film, I thought, well, you know, first off, I feel like I want to write another book. And that's what we did. But it wasn't just write the second book. I thought we've got to produce a movie at the same time. And that's what we did, Gift Wrapped and Gutted. And that's the same title on both things. The same title for my book, the second book, which was Gift Wrapped and Gutted, the trashiest Christmas horror movies ever made. We did a movie, Gift Wrapped and Gutted, with Wave Productions, Gary Whitson, who I was such a big fan of. But Gary, just going through the numbers, Gary is the most prolific shot on video director of the time frame that I looked at in that first book. He's made hundreds of movies. And I thought, you know, he also specialized in custom movies. So in other words, you give him the script or the idea, the storyline, he can try to make the movie for you. And I thought, this is perfect, because I only have basically a year to get the second book out, right, to get to the next Christmas, and I'm always writing. So if Gary can make the movie, you know, this could really work. So I got to write with Gary Whitson. I got to co-produce with Gary Whitson, and he made this movie that starred practically all the Wave stars. I mean, we've got Tina Krause in there. He's got Laura Gigolo in there, you know. I mean, and then this amazing new cast in there too. So it was such an experience to do that second book and to be working distanced, but to send and get information back and forth, working on that production, having the finished film ready for the release date of the book. Oh, what a dream come true. I still can't believe we accomplished it. Because Gary had to shoot during the summer, which meant he had to take all his old Christmas tree props and everything out from storage he just put away. So, and then that book, the second book, the Christmas book, Gift Wrapped and Gutted, we didn't want just interviews with people who had been in Christmas horror films. I sat there and I thought, you know what, I'm going to get everybody I can think of who's willing to write and has the time, because most people don't have availabilities in their schedules. That's the main deal, is if they're too busy. But let's get just anyone in horror and talk about Christmas past, like what was Christmas to them, what was their best memory, things like that. So we got Jack Shoulder in there. I say we, but it's me. But I mean, Jack Shoulder, the director of Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 and Alone in the Dark. Mm-hmm. You know, many of the people came back. Doug Stone is back. You know, we've got Phil Herman in there. Very touching stories. Exhooker's Christmas Carol got a huge chapter on the making of it that Dave was able to write, like practically the entire memory he had from that experience in that book, because we really wanted to get that featured in there. Just incredible amount of talent. And in fact, there's some stories in the Gift Wrapped and Gutted book that were impressive enough that they needed to be submitted to the Academy of, who is it? The Academy of Arts and Sciences, the people that put on the Oscars. They keep records on for like history of filmmakers, things like that, for retrospectives. And some of the stories we had in that book related to childhood stories, what inspired them to become filmmakers. And a copy of that book is now submitted and in the archives of the Academy of Arts and Sciences in LA. I couldn't believe it. And that was a really amazing thing, just to have that there. I mean, one day they're going to pull this book out and look up, you know, the person they're looking for, and then sit there and say, oh, yeah, well, you know, this person was in here. This person's story was in here. And, I mean, Mark Polonia is in there, stories about him and his brother John when they were young with, you know, Christmas Santa and snowmen dolls and stuff. And there's picture. There's a picture of them. Just amazing things. But one of the things I learned from the writing experience, beyond the generosity and the time and just the knowledge, the pure knowledge, and everyone I asked, you know, what do you think about today's distribution? How do you think you would move towards distribution deals now? And I got such good information. One of the things I learned was Tim Ritter. Tim Ritter from Truth or Dare and Creep and Wicked Games and all those great things. Well, Tim Ritter doesn't just write a response when you ask him to write something. He literally goes on and he explains and he goes on. He writes a lot. And I thought, this is fantastic. It, I mean, not just to look and read at, but he is giving so many details. And he said this to me. He goes, you know, some people say I write too much and they don't like it. I said, no way. And it's been that way ever since, that Tim loves to explain. And I love to hear. He writes so much. It's inspired me. So now when I'm writing it, I'm sending out things. You know, you sort of know your audience, whether it's going to, you know, is this just going to flop off and it's not going to work. But the more details and the more in-depth you go and the more explanation you give, it is a benefit, especially in independent cinema, because you're sharing secrets. And that is, it's inspired me in the way I write now, in the way I just in converse with friends is, you know, I mean, I don't want to make a meal of everything, but when they're looking for the details, you know, it's about explaining and sharing. Never have the feeling like you want to keep something secret. You know, someone will steal my idea. I don't want to share this with them. No, share it. The more you share, the better it gets. And the more you share amongst other people, the more it grows to become reality. I often say that there is no such thing as failure. It's really true. Failure is not just, you know, I tried and I failed. Failure is a state of mind. Everything is a learning experience. And if you fail, you learn what not to do the next time, what works better. So be happy if you fail on something, because it's just it's just what they call a failure. You know, it's just another do it. You can keep trying. So I often say that. But yeah, I'll keep rolling if it's okay, Mac.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to interject one little thing talking about that. Quote unquote failure has also been the inspiration of different things. A lot of the things that were invented because of a failure with something else.
Very true. Absolutely. I didn't even think about that. That is so on the money. Yes.
Or accidental. Like, did you know that chocolate, a lot of people don't know this because it's like it's part of history, but you know how history sometimes gets laid by the wayside. A lot of people don't know that the reason why they call the one company calls chocolate chip cookies Toll House cookies is because this lady called Mrs. Toll House, she is the one that she didn't invent them. It was totally accidental. She was making cookies and she knocked in the chocolate chips into the cookie dough. And she's like, oh, no, what am I going to do with this? So she just decided to go ahead and bake it into the cookies. And that's where chocolate chip cookies came from. It was a total accident.
I didn't know that at all. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell my wife now.
And that's why the one company, Keebler, you know, that's why they call them Toll House Cookies, because they're giving homage to her for that. Because if it wasn't for her making a mistake, we wouldn't have chocolate chip cookies.
That is a story. My gosh. And my wife's sick of hearing film talk, so I would love to repeat that to her. That is fantastic. Those are those happy accidents in life that make something better than you could imagine.
Right.
That's sort of what I try to harvest with performance. to talk about how I would shoot a picture, and this is something I always have done now. Actually, I started in the beginning, but I didn't articulate it to the point of now I'm looking for it. The actors, they know what the scene is. And I often now don't even have scripted dialogue. I'll give them the basics of, like, this is a blueprint of the scene and this is the basics of dialogue. So they have a sense of exactly what it is we're doing. But they don't have the exact sense of, you know, screen direction and dialogue. And I say to them, listen, you are the character. You are this, you know, say you're a Bigfoot hunter. You're hunting Bigfoot. You are here in the woods. And this person wants to stop you. So if what you want to say to them is going to make you go ahead and hunt Bigfoot, say whatever you have to say. Their job is to stop you, but you know what you want to say because you're the hunter. You want to say, listen, I'm determined. I got to go. Whatever it is, I got to hunt Bigfoot. And I give them that much open window space that they can either take it and run with it. They can make it as quick. And if it's too quick, I'll say, no, sorry, guys, stretch it out. We got to do that again. But the point is I give them an opportunity to improv live. Mm-hmm. And that's usually the take I use in the film, is the live improv take. Usually it's first or second take. Because, you know, as long as I have my key moments of what I'm looking for, I let that open area end up that the actor or whoever it is can put up forth. And that's where I'm looking for those mistakes. If they do something and something really off the wall happens, like people are fighting over a prop and say the prop breaks, you know, when you didn't mean it for it to break, I'll leave that in the movie and then cut to the scene where it's back fixed again. You know, that's what I'll do, because I think that's life. Life is about the accidents, and then, you know, they're unexpected. But if you give them room, you'll have some.
Well, believe it or not, we're down to like 8 minutes. And
oh my gosh!
I did want,
oh, there's so much I want to say.
Yeah,
that
time just flies by.
It does
so
fly.
I
but
don't,
listen, I'll just there's something I want to read at the end too. So if you can give me maybe a 3 minute warning, that would be wonderful. But I just really want to quickly say two things. Right now, Rick Mill Productions, you know, like I said, we put the two books out and we sort of sit dormant because of COVID. I mean, I've put together Easter Bunny 2, but it's sort of soft served on the internet. You know, it's just sort of Vimeo sitting right now. So that's going to be coming out as a special edition. All the rights of the films I talked about, they're coming back, and they're coming back in a brand new line. Rick Mill Video. We're having our own line of videotapes. And I don't know about videotapes. I'm trying about that. But DVDs and perhaps Blu-ray, they're coming out. All our films are coming back in brand new special editions. New commentaries, because I can talk and I never give up. Keep going. I learned that from Dave the Rock Nelson, everybody. You keep going. You keep going. Oh, yeah. Anyway, beyond that, right now I'm editing a film I shot years ago. It was the third picture we did. It's a space movie. It's basically Slumber Party Massacre meets Aliens from Outer Space. And it was called Candy Pickles and the Alien Invaders. For a while, I called it Hot Chicks Blast Uranus. But I think maybe I'll go back to the Candy Pickles. Candy Pickles and the Alien Invaders.
Actually,
and
I
it's
like
really
that
sensitive.
Other title.
You like the Hot Chicks. You know, most people like the Hot Chicks. I just don't want to offend anybody, you know. But that movie, you know, I actually forgot until
I
started
cutting it.
I like the
Uranus part. That's funny.
You like the Uranus. You know, nothing's set in stone yet, so I'll keep looking. But, you know, the thing is, that picture, I've tried a lot to get really nice cinematography. We did some stuff in that movie. The visuals are fantastic. We got superimposed things, puppets. Everything is puppet aliens, so it's physical in your scene. It's not special like CGI. It's live. You know, and just stuff like if the aliens attack you, frankly, it's attacking a woman's chest and shaking it back and forth. You know, I mean, we really tried to give some good visuals to the movie, and it's not salacious. It's not at all. It's very, very friendly. You know, in fact, I try to make movies that my kids would be proud of. In fact, Bigfoot Ate My Boyfriend was intended for my kids. I just so happened to have a scene where a guy was whacking off under a sheet, but it was true to character. He was so full of himself. So, you know, there's that. But beyond that, this is a bit more serious now. I'm also trying, and I've been trying for about a year, as long as COVID's been around, to get a new picture off the ground. Clean, brand new, new production, everything. And this is coming post the experience of the two books and all the wealth of experience of learning from the masters. But this new picture is a comeback for Rick Mill Productions. It's the comeback, and it's probably the new dominant thing for the Rickmo line. It's a throwback to Ed Wood, but looking forward, that recognizes what life is like now with COVID, with masks, with some concern about being too close to people. We address that in this movie. And by God, this movie is going to deliver the laugh that this world needs. Sincerity in its humor and sincerity in what it's doing. It's about a little bit of a backstory for a previous character I have. There's a great Bigfoot investigator I've used many times called John Sarius. That's the character's name. Well, in the first movie he's in the Bigfoot movie, you find out he had his dick ripped off by Bigfoot. So he has revenge for Bigfoot. Well, he's gone on to investigate aliens. He's investigated the Easter Bunny. Now is the movie where we give him a real backstory and we find out what makes this character tick. This character has been only played by one actor, the great Kirk Manuwira, and he is fantastic. He is a Rickmo king, and there is a Rickmo queen as well, Caitlin L. Yerku. But I'll get back to what I'm doing because I only have a couple minutes here. We're going to explain his backstory, and the backstory is he lost the love of his life, and she went missing, unexplained missing. And just when he's come back to town and he's reminiscing about his lost love, he's approached with a new mission to find a missing girl who, by picture that he sees, absolutely resembles his lost love. And that prompts him onto a journey like no other. Again, this is during COVID, so we recognize that there is social distancing and masks. But this is a movie unlike any other. It is called Bride of the Cockroach. And that movie we got to put together. I have met a girl who is not a professional actor. She may not even be an actor at all. But she's beautiful beyond words. And I'm telling you, she is the epitome of gorgeousness. And to have her in a film would be so fantastic. I would explain it just by one look of her. I'd say, now you understand why anyone would go crazy 15 years after losing her. Because she is so beautiful, the most beautiful girl in cinema. And I'll make sure you understand.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you wanted a three-minute warning. So
3 minutes? Oh, I sure do, Max. Thank you. The reason, thank you for giving me the time for all this explanation. The reason I would like 3 minutes is because I just wanted to read a small passage from Analog Nightmares. This is towards the end. And this is something I think is really summed up with what I've said here. And I'll paraphrase a little bit here. It says, I hope readers are as inspired by the stories, by the masters who I've interviewed, the films we've looked at, as I was. And hearing from them, hearing them say the words that you as the reader can do it. You can do it too. You can make movies. It's remarkable. They know what they're talking about. I've witnessed it. These men and women took hold of a new format. It was VHS at the time, but VHS is on a comeback. It's really never gone away, to be honest with you. But using a camcorder and making it your own, finding distribution is still happening. It is still happening, even now. Physical media is alive. Take everything serious that you do, even the silly stuff. Make it seriously silly. Do your best and try your hardest. And at the end of the day, distribution can be found if you reach for it. That's true for every filmmaker, even today, even during COVID. The tools to make your own movie are in your hands. You just need to charge the batteries. Put that camcorder to use. Film what you think is funny, even if people say it's terrible. Do it. Make your movie. And if you can do that, you can work towards distribution. If anybody is lost and they don't know where to find movies, or they don't know how to get their movies put out in distribution, my book tells you, and it's not a big secret. Ron Bach literally gave me his email address to be published, where you can contact somebody and say, hey, I've got a movie. I'd like to talk about putting it out. And it's there. It's for anybody who's ready. Independence lies. Gosh, there's guys out there in Texas making movies because they say they were inspired by me. I can't believe it. Magma Productions, Magma Films. I couldn't believe it. But it's true. Everything we do inspires somebody else. Anyway, thank you for those 3 minutes there, Mac.
Oh, that's quite all right. And we're down to like 30 seconds. So is there anything that you would like to say in closing? Because that's about all we have time for.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I just want to say that I really love everybody. Love is the secret to the world. I mean that in a truthful way. If you can just respect somebody for their opinions and love everybody, we all can work together to be better. And take care. Be safe. And guys, the sun will come up tomorrow, no matter what happens. I love you.
Okay. Thanks for being on the show. My guest was Richard Mogg, very interesting person to talk with. And stay safe and have a good night and goodbye.
Thank you.
Bye.